Next case on the docket is Edgar Edmundo Marino versus Commonwealth. Mr. Griffith, Ms. Kiernan, we have to hear from you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Griffith, do you need any rebuttal time?
I would best reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Certainly. Okay, we're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Daniel Griffith. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Edgar Edmundo Moreno. Following jury trial and post-trial motions in this matter, Mr. Moreno was left with the sole conviction for uttering a forged public record in violation of Virginia Code 18.2168. That conviction triggers the issues with respect to this appeal, specifically whether a document not prepared by a public officer or agency or employee of an agency and received contrary to the statutory requirements of 19.2151 can be considered a public record under the definition provided in the Virginia Code at 42.1-77. 42.177 defines a public record and further became the law of this case in so much as jury instruction was provided to the jurors in this matter that gave 42.177 in its entirety. The first sentence of 42.177 reads that a public record is a document that records information that documents a transaction by or with a public officer, agency, or employee of an agency. And that first sentence is critical to the first issue presented on the appeal in this case. It indicates that the document itself, the information, which can take any number of forms as is provided by the second sentence as amended in 2005 of the statute, but the document must nonetheless document a transaction by or with a public officer. Now, in this case, the court is privy, obviously, to what was trial exhibit number 2, which is the proposed letter documenting a private agreement between two private individuals that was received by the court, and we'll deal with those issues in a little while, but was received by the court in anticipation of court and satisfaction and discharge pursuant to 19.2-151. And it really creates an issue of first impression for the appellate courts of Virginia. Certainly the court's privy to the briefs in this matter, which reference the prior cases that have considered convictions under 19.2-168. And I point out for the court that some of the decisions cited in the briefs, certainly for the Commonwealth, don't even really seem to address specifically the issue of the definition of public record under 19.2-168. Specifically, the Bennett case cited by the Commonwealth in this matter doesn't really have a lot of discussion of whether or not the construction license that was applied for in that case does in fact constitute a public record. Therefore, I think any impact it would have upon the court's decision is certainly eliminated by a lack of discussion in the opinion itself. But the other cases that have considered these matters, for example, Reed, talking about a fingerprint card prepared by law enforcement officers, or there's the Gibson matter talking about a bail bond form prepared by a magistrate to allow the release of an individual. What all of those cases have in common is a situation where a form is prepared and generally information is provided by a public official. You basically have a situation where a form is prepared and the interaction with the other party to the transaction is in fact initiated by a public official in all of those cases with the fingerprint card, with a commercial driver's license application such as in Bennett, with respect to the bail bond form in the Gibson case. Whereas in this situation, what you're presented with is a form ostensibly prepared by two private individuals, not pursuant to a court order, not under any direction of the court, but specifically indicating an agreement that I provided you $100. I'm satisfied that that takes care of any issues that I have with respect to the interaction between you and I in this case. What the Commonwealth has done, both in the extensive post-trial practice in this matter as well as in its brief in this case, has attempted to extend the application of 18.2.161 well past what any plain reading of the statute would actually provide for in the case. And it's certainly something that Judge Benton warned against in his dissent in Koch, which is an unpublished opinion of this court, and by my research, the last time that this court has actually taken up specifically this notion of defining public record for the purpose of a violation of 18.2-168. And in that opinion, in his dissent, Judge Benton indicates that not every paper prepared by a public officer constitutes a public record. Here we go one step further. We don't even have a public official being involved in the creation of the paper, the document that's being presented in this case, for the purpose of establishing a violation of 18.2-168. It's simply private individuals. It's received by the court, and it's received by the court not pursuant to the requirements of 19.2-151. But that goes to the second sentence, and we can't eliminate and not consider the first sentence of 42.1-77. I've cited in my brief, obviously, the Waldrop opinion from the Virginia Supreme Court, which cites the well-worn...
Can I ask you on that, Mr. Griffith? The first sentence you're speaking of is the first sentence of the public record or record definition.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the recorded information, it means recorded information that documents a transition, transaction, or activity by or with any public officer, agency, or employee of an agency. Why isn't this a transaction or activity with a public agency? Because it's with the court. And this has to be submitted in order for the next thing to happen that your client wanted to have happen.
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that the court can ignore the verb in the first sentence, which is that it must document the transaction. Specifically, the recorded information must document the transaction with the public agency or official. And that's where the other cases that have dealt with this issue really fall on the other side of this issue as opposed to what happened in this case. In all of the other cases, you have a situation where someone is interacting at the behest of a probation officer. It's prepared by a probation officer. Likewise, interacting with law enforcement, interacting with DMV or another public agency.
So how would they have done it here, could they have done it here, that it would have met your definition for public record? Or could it have been done in this sort of situation?
I'm going to take that two ways, Your Honor. First of all, I don't think that an agreement amongst private individuals that is documented in the four corners of the document with information that's not provided for the court can ever rise to the level of a public record. By way of example, I would indicate to the court that if, for example, an attorney were to come to court with a forged contract, and forged contract involving a private transaction within between two parties, and they presented that contract to the court, sought and got a default judgment based upon that private contract, that's still not a public record per the definition, because the definition requires that it documents a transaction by or with. That might be a 172 forgery, certainly, because...
Counsel, let me interrupt you for a second, if I may. What about the fact that this, you would agree with me, would you not, that a court in satisfaction, they're sort of a unique animal. They're a little bit different. They're not a contract between two people. They're not the writing on the back of a warrant dismissing a charge. It is something that effectuates the writing on the warrant dismissing the charge, but it would become part of the court's file. Is that right?
With respect to that question, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in 151 that requires the court to make the writing part of the file in the case. The way that I describe the accord and satisfaction construct under 19.2.151 is that it gives the court discretionary authority upon the satisfactions of conditions precedent, and specifically the segues into the second issue raised on appeal. Those conditions precedent are that the court receive an acknowledgement in writing. Mm-hmm. And we certainly have some confusion based upon the code of exactly what constitutes an acknowledgement, since we know that other sections of the code indicate that an acknowledgement is something that's actually notarized, which is something that was brought up.
There's no requirement for a notarization on accord and satisfaction, though, is there?
Your Honor, I think that's unclear in the statute, because it certainly refers to an acknowledgement. Even if the court were to determine that there is no requirement for a notarization, there most certainly is a patent requirement that the complaining witness with respect to the criminal charge be present at the time and prior to the court receiving any information pertaining to an accord of satisfaction. That was not adhered to. It's uncontested in the record that, in fact, the complaining witness in this case was not present at the time at which the court received this information. Therefore, that segues into the argument of whether or not the documents received pursuant to law. The court only has the discretion to act upon an accord of satisfaction if the statutory conditions precedent are in fact followed in this case. And they weren't, because we know that the defendant wasn't present. Therefore, the court didn't even have the discretion or the authority to receive the document if the court wants to follow along the line that every document that a court receives therefore becomes part of the public record, which is not supported by any case law either of this court or the Virginia Supreme Court, and is clearly contrary to the clear words of the statute. And I suggest to the court that that kind of reading, if anything, leads to an absurd result that would be contrary to the general rules of statutory construction when you're talking about interpretation of a statute. And in this case, since the General Assembly has sought to penalize persons specifically for forging or uttering public records and has incorporated its definition of public record into that statute, we have to construe that definition of public record strictly against the Commonwealth, as both the drafters of the statute itself, as well as generally with respect to the rule of lenity in this case, Your Honor.
So what's the answer? I'm assuming you're right. Obviously, we don't like people coming in with forged documents, manipulating the court process in this way. Is it perjury? Is that the answer? Is it something else?
Well, perjury certainly has other requirements. I mean, there's no indication that there's been a provision of an oath or anything, which would be a prerequisite with respect to perjury. With respect to litigants, and certainly a litigant's going to apply whether someone is counseled or uncounseled, there are obviously 271(1) sanctions that can be applied to someone who attempts to defraud a court. And there may be other criminal statutes involved. As I indicated, specifically, depending upon what the forged document is, if it works to the prejudice of another person, then the person may very well be subject to punishment under 18.2-172, which would be a different punishment as far as that goes. But nonetheless, it doesn't get us away from the requirement that what the document itself documents in its four corners must be a transaction by or with a public agency. And that's simply...
Why isn't the transaction with the public agency the tendering of a plea of accord and satisfaction?
Well, Your Honor, if the court looks to Exhibit 2, nowhere within Exhibit 2 doesn't ask the court to do anything specifically. It indicates I don't wish to go forward, but it doesn't ask or require the court to do anything. And if we follow that line of reasoning, then we get to a notion where every single pleading that's tendered that might possibly be forged also constitutes a public record for which one could be punished for forgery of a public record. And again, the four corners of the document don't establish in any way that documents a transaction by or with a public agency official or employee of an agency.
Okay, and you're starting to get into your two-minute rebuttal time. You're welcome to keep going or to not.
That's quite all right, I'll step back and reserve my rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Kiernan?
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Elizabeth Kiernan on behalf of the Commonwealth. The document at issue in this case is a public record. It does document a transaction or activity by or with, well, not by, but with a public officer, in this case, the trial court. And I disagree with counsel's characterization of this document as a document that solely refers to an action between private parties. If you look at the accord and satisfaction, which is on 296 of the appendix, it references a case number. It says regarding accord and satisfaction. It references the case number again in the body and says they don't want to proceed. This is not a contract between two private people. This is an application to a trial court seeking action from that court in its official capacity as a judicial officer. And in fact, this letter was handed up, and the relief sought in the letter was given by the trial court in the exercise of its discretion and administering its docket for that day. This letter meets the standard definition under 42.176 of a public record.
How do you respond to Mr. Griffith's answer to my question, and that the verb documents isn't covered here?
Well, Your Honor, I think the word documents is covered here. This letter is a request. It documents a request to the trial court for this case to be dismissed. This is not a letter that says, the letter is not between two people. It's clearly directed at a third party. It's documenting the activity of requesting this, requesting from the court this relief, the same as an application for a driver's license requests from the DMV a duplicate license in Bennett, or the application for bail requests from the magistrate that a bond be granted in a certain case. All of those applications, much like this application, document a transaction between an applicant, and in this case the trial court, in those cases other public agencies. And it's not significant in this case that the letter was handwritten or that it wasn't on a pre-provided form. The plain language of 46.276 says, regardless of its form or characteristics, it's clearly meant to be applied broadly. And there's no material difference between a pre-prepared form and a form that was prepared, in this case, at the direction of the trial court. The defendant testified at trial, and it's at Appendix 150, that the trial court told him when he showed up for the first time that if his uncle, the victim, didn't wish to proceed, they needed to come back to court with a letter to that effect. And he did just that. This was a letter prepared, moreover, at the direction of the court. And so I would argue it falls more in line with those cases of the probation officer report and also the DMV records, et cetera. This is a document that was prepared at the court's request, which I think further marshals in favor there.
Isn't that going a little further than the plain language of the statute contemplates? I mean, it's one thing to say these are your options as opposed to go and do this. I mean, the court didn't say, you know, if you don't, I mean, for example, you need to pay child support or else. I mean, that's an order or direction from the court.
Sure.
But to say this case will go away if this contingency happens, that's not really the court saying go out and do this.
Sure, Your Honor. It was the court directing the parties as what their avenue for relief was. If this is what you want to do, here's your avenue for relief, which I think really only is important insofar as it cements that this is a transaction with the court. This is a document that was prepared to present to the court. The court suggested that the parties present this if
Why isn't the activity or transaction, the tendering of an accordant and satisfaction plea, this letter documents that plea, and it's with an officer of the court, or the, in this instance, the judge.
I agree with that characterization, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think that characterization falls, it complies with the kid section, as Your Honor has phrased it in that sentence.
What about the part of 19.2-151 that talks about if the person injured appears before the court and acknowledges in writing that he has received satisfaction for the injury?
Your Honor, I don't think it's determinative of the issue before this court whether the General District Court properly accepted this document. The court had discretion to do so, and even if the court abuses discretion in that case, it doesn't make that entire action a nullity. And furthermore, for the defendant to argue at this point in the proceeding that the document which he tendered to the court and was accepted and he benefited from, now he's saying the court was wrong to do that, is taking inconsistent positions and runs afoul of this court's prohibition of approbating and reprobating. For him to have proffered that document to the court, asked the court to accept and rely on it, and now say, actually, you were wrong to do that, and I shouldn't have to suffer the consequences. A ruling that any error by a judicial officer in accepting a form like that vitiates the whole proceeding would insulate defendants like this from the consequences of their actions and can't be what the statute intended in this case. Code sections are construed to avoid absurd results, and insulating a criminal defendant from liability for lying to the court surely wasn't what was meant under this code section. So I would argue that whether or not the General District Court erred in accepting this document has no impact on its status as a public record. Even if it wasn't accepted in pursuance of law, it was still accepted in connection with the transaction of public business, which is also in that in the definition there.
I don't know that the answer would change if the court had rejected it by saying, well, yeah, you've given me this document, it's probably legit, but I need to see your uncle here because the statute requires that. And if so, the court said, you know, here's the record back. I don't know that that would matter, that the court had accepted or rejected it. I mean, it either falls within the definition or it doesn't.
Sure. And to Your Honor's point, that's similar to the situation in Bennett where the guy proffered false information to get a duplicate license from the DMV, and he left before the clerk ever gave it to him. He said, I never got the license, so I didn't follow through with it. And the court in Bennett held that didn't matter, much to Your Honor's point, that the transaction was complete once this was offered up in court. And at that point, a forged public record had been uttered, just as the jury found in this case.
Right.
Unless the court has any further questions, I'd ask you all to affirm the judgment of the circuit court.
We always appreciate brevity. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have your 2-minute rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the first statement by the court, the argument of the Commonwealth that the accord and satisfaction letter, Exhibit 2, somehow documents the transaction by or with a public official, I'd suggest to the court that it does not. As the court indicated that it was perhaps a suggestion of the court, it certainly wasn't done pursuant to an order or anything else. And in fact, what documents the transaction involving the accord and satisfaction is in Exhibit 2, which is in 269 of the appendix, but actually it's the warrant with the language on the back signed by the court indicating that the accord and satisfaction has in fact been granted, which is 271, 272 in the appendix. What differentiates this case from all the other cases the court's considered and cited by the Commonwealth is in the other cases you were always dealing with a situation where the court where the receiving agency had either some sort of statutory duty or was under some sort of court order to actually receive the information. They had a requirement to do so. In this case, the court had a requirement not to receive this document because the statutory conditions precedent were not satisfied prior to the court receiving the document. What the court had the duty to do was to ask, where's the victim? Because without that victim being present, the court doesn't have the discretion to act and to grant the accord and satisfaction in this case, Your Honor, to even receive this document to constitute a public record. But that cuts back to whether or not it fits the statutory description in this case, Your Honor. And the Commonwealth argues that the second sentence pertaining to recorded information is meant to be applied broadly. Well, that's with respect to form, Your Honor. If the court will look at the legislative history of 42.177, prior to the amendment in 2005, that second sentence was kind of a litany of microfiche, microfilm, all those sorts of things, and they wanted to cut through, you know, all the mustard as far as that goes. And when they amended it, they simply said, well, regardless of form, it's going to be a public record. But that doesn't eliminate the requirement that it comply with sentence one in this case. And it must, to comply with sentence one, must document within its own four corners a transaction between a public agency official or an employee of the agency and another party. And what is documented in Exhibit 2 is an agreement between two private individuals. The Commonwealth cites to Bennett for this notion of whether or not utterance was completed with respect to presentation, even though it wasn't officially received. Well, I'd suggest to the court, a close reading of Bennett suggests that whether or not that disqualified something as a public record wasn't briefed. What was before the court in Bennett was simply whether or not utterance had taken place, and it's not really applicable to the issue before the court with respect to whether or not this document among private individuals constitutes a public record under 42-177 and 182-168.
All right. Thank you for your argument. We'll come down and greet counsel and take up the final case on the docket, Whiting v. City of Charlottesville.